Hello and welcome to CICK News. CICK News is your local and regional news coverage provided by me, Pamela Hassan, and Dan Messick for Smithers Community Radio. This news program is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada, and our aim is to provide local coverage on stories that affect the lives of Northerners like you. Today on CICK News, the Northwest Fire Centre, located in Smithers, coordinates the wildfire response for an area which covers over 24 million hectares, which is a quarter of the province, stretching from the west coast of just west of Indaco and from the Yukon border to Tweedsmuir Provincial Park. The Northwest Fire Centre encompasses part of the undulating interior plateau as well as the rugged coastal mountain range. The forests in this area consist primarily of pine and spruce trees. Balsam can also be found in higher elevations, with hemlock and red cedar becoming more prevalent along the coast. Managing this massive area's wildfire season is the job of the Lithe crew at the Northwest Fire Centre. And today, I want to share a series of interviews I conducted before the interregnum, which is the period between the writ being dropped and the swearing-in of a new captain. Due to our current provincial election coming up this Saturday, October 19th, the Fire Centre is currently in the state of interregnum. Maybe when you think of a wildfire, you picture a firefighter strapped into a helicopter waiting to rappel into dangerous terrain. And yes, that actually is accurate at times, but the stages of circumspection and planning that need to happen before a crew is deployed is what this episode of CICK News is focused on. This past summer was about a quarter of the previous wildfires that BC experienced in 2023, but the work of fire prevention officers, operations managers, and dispatchers keep ticking along, trying to move the needle on how best to fight fires in that over 24 million hectares of mountains, forests, scrub, farms, and houses, better known as BC's Northwest.
My name is Maya Buchanan, and I'm the dispatch supervisor for the Northwest Fire Centre. This is my fifth season with BC Wildfire, so I've dispatched for the last four, and I just graduated, so this is my first year doing the full-time, year-round supervision of the room.
So I kind of just want to start with the basics of what happens in the center and what your role in all of those happenings and goings on actually is.
We're one of six fire centers where we regionally organize and respond to incidents and organize the resources that are going to them. So we, in the dispatch room, we take all, if you ever call into the 1-800 center or the star 5555, if you call in, you'll get a call taker in Victoria, and then those will come up on our screen and they'll start flashing. And so if there's a big incident, we'll often get dozens and dozens of what we call initial phone reports, so IPRs, and they pop up on our screen and we triage them. Essentially, we bring them to the ops person, and then they will tell us, okay, deploy this crew, or we're going to hold and wait for more reports, or I'm going to call the caller. Because if you call in and report a fire and they ask for your phone number, you might get called back by one of our wildfire officers.
My name is Chris Worrell. I'm the acting senior wildfire officer operations at the Northwest Fire Center. I think for the Northwest operationally, some of our challenges are just the vast area that we're responsible for. We're responsible from almost Indaco all the way up to the Yukon border and then out to the Rocks. It's a very large area.
And then we will call the aircraft or the crew or the officer that we're sending out to the incident. We'll cut a fire number. So when you look on the app and you see all the fires in the fire center, you'll have a 5-digit number. We plot it on the map based off of reports from our ground crews. And we talk to all the resources that are going out to the fires. So any of our initial attack, unit crews, parattack, rap attack, whatever, we talk to them. We do safety check-ins.
Parattack is where they jump out of planes with a parachute to respond to a fire.
So usually in remote kind of flat terrain. So often in our CASCR zone, which is the northwestmost part of our fire center.
And rapid attack, or rap attack, is where you rappel down a rope.
So that's often used for really mountainous, tricky terrain that a helicopter potentially couldn't land at. And maybe there's no safe place for hover exit. Those are all different types of crews that we'll have. And they will do safety monitoring with us because, as we have learned so tragically over the last few years, this is such a dangerous line of work. And so at the very basic function, we are a safety role. So we do whatever, like 2-hour check-ins for ground personnel or 30-minute check-ins for aircraft. And so if a check-in is missed, then we initiate processes to track you down. And then if we're not able to track you down, that's a hint that something might be going on and that you might need to go track you down, kind of thing. Or that maybe something bad will have happened. And then we also manage all communications in and out of the fire center. So ground crews or helicopter will let us know what the fire is doing fire behavior wise. We will log that because we also serve a legal function. So all things that happen on a fire, we have to log, because if we ever get sued, it's essentially the kind of the transcript of everything that's happened on a fire. So who was there? What was happening? When did they get there? When did they leave? When were they bucketing? That kind of thing. So we do that and we'll pass that information along to whoever it needs to go to. So say it's, oh, this fire is suddenly 100 hectares bigger than we thought it was and it's close to some cabins. The dispatcher will take that information and they'll pass that along to the appropriate op staff or officer based on the zone that the fire is happening in. And then they will send resources accordingly.
I'm Brad Martin. I'm the Senior Wildfire Officer for Prevention in the Northwest Fire Center.
How involved is prevention in fire mitigation in the off season? When is your kind of busiest time of year?
It does depend on the fire season. So if operationally the fire season is slow, we will continue with our prevention activities year round, including the operational fire season. And that can be anything from public education to utilizing our crews for wildfire risk reduction, so fuel management, prescribed fire projects. And then the winters are more about planning of this kind of activities that we can take out on the landscape when it's snow free.
The diversity in the ecology of BC's Northwest consists of many different fuel types, consisting of fine fuels like small twigs, leaves, needles, grasses, or ferns, or any other lightweight or small in diameter material, coarse fuels, which are larger combustible materials such as logs, stumps, trees, large limbs, and treetops. Size relates directly to the amount of heat required for fuels to reach ignition temperature. The map of fire behavior prediction, or FPB, fuel types was derived primarily from forest data based on satellite imagery acquired by NASA's Moderate Resolution Imaging Spectrodiameter sensors. Fuel types were assigned based on vegetation type, tree species, crown closure, stand height, and other attributes, broken down into behavioral fuel models and fuel groups.
Yeah, so we have many different fuel types here. We have anything from semi-arid deserts all the way till that coastal rainforest type.
And operations, are you working with prevention? I got the hand gesture earlier, which I guess now in a audio format, no one knows what I just did, but about the way that prevention and operations works. Are you also creating and using reports about land use in the off season? What do you feel like is the kind of main functions during the off season for operation?
The off season for us, I guess operations can be broken out into a couple different streams. So at the fire center here, what we're doing is working on more of the regional coordination center. So how we respond, our dispatch systems, the coordination side of things. And I guess you could say the zones tend to be a little bit more involved with sort of the prevention work, but supported out of the fire center. In the zones, that's where you have your crews and some other officers that tend to get a little bit more involved with those local level projects.
There was a study released this year regarding wildland fuel management data in BC's interior, and it found that most of the data collected by fire behavior prediction systems was mislabeled, meaning that fuels that were more harmful or likely to exacerbate a wildfire were not accounted for. I'm wondering if you can describe the relationship between data response to wildfires and the operation and how the operation department conducts itself.
This one I might pass over to Brad here just because he was actually down to visit some of those sites post-wildfire post-operations.
Here's Brad Martin again, speaking about the Canadian Forest Fire Danger Rating System and how it determines what operations and prevention need to map out for their best approach for fighting fires in the Northwest.
That report is nothing new to us. It's not a surprise. The report itself is new. We've known this for many years that our fuel typing, which is what it speaks to, is incorrect within the forests of British Columbia. The forests of British Columbia are extremely diverse. And what's trying to happen is they're trying to fit those forests into one of the 16 fuel types that we use with the Canadian Forest Fire Danger Rating System. So a lot of them just don't fit. And that's the reality. That's the science side of things. So that comes back to us with our experience and spending time in the bush and understanding our forests and see how they burn under a variety of conditions, and using that for our response data
We do use our fuel type information, but we always take it with a grain of salt.
Okay, so then are you creating your own, like your own maps and data about the Northwest Center?
It's a real challenge. It's a real challenge. There's 16 recognized fuel types that we can use for our fire behavior, and some of them just do not accurately represent the forest fuels in British Columbia. So it's not, it's one thing to say that they're a mismatch, but even if we fit them into one of the 16 fuel types, we are still going to not have the results that we expect from a fire behavior perspective.
So you think that the actual scope needs to be widened then when labeling?
Yeah, the Canadian Forest Fire Danger Rating System was primarily built for all of Canada and primarily for the boreal. And so there's a lot of forest types in British Columbia that aren't represented by the science. That's a gap. And that's why we rely on experience and what we call more the art side of it. So when you have people that have been working in areas for long periods of time and are used to these different fuel types and have seen fire in them, that's a big component that we add to our science side to determine the best response and how we're going to go after that fire.
Now back to Maya in dispatch.
There's no one function that dispatch holds, and it totally depends on the fire season, but it's a hub of information and providing that safety piece, because if there ever is like a medical emergency on the fire line, or if in the very, very rare and tragic circumstance of a downed aircraft, we are the ones who have to respond to it and have to send the crews, like the, you have to call 911 and dispatch crews accordingly. It can be pretty stressful in there, but yeah, maybe like a jack of all trades kind of thing in there for sure.
So in order to effectively manage the dispatch center and the crews on site during a fire, what support does an operations manager need from other departments and or other fire centers as well?
So what I would say locally is, you know, it is built out. We do have a full dispatch room that we do staff fully from May until the end of September. That's the, we'll call it the brains there. That's our connection between the coordination center and the field. And then on top of that, what we have at the fire center often is someone who is the regional wildfire coordination officer overseeing all of the response for the Northwest. And then at certain periods of activity, we'll initiate an operations officer, which will oversee each one of our zones and help with the response and guide the zones in that.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we can see it coming when we have lightning forecasted, so we'll anticipate a lightning event or a lightning bus, as you'll sometimes refer to it, especially if it's coming with the adjacent weather that is whatever supportive of spread and ignition, we will know about it. So we'll maybe staff up in advance, but often it comes when you don't expect it with holdover potential. So if you have a lightning strike one day, but then you don't have the necessary winds and temperatures, maybe until even up to a month or a year later, this can happen. So we're often just, we operate with a lot of preparedness. So we're make sure that everything's ready to go if anything hits at any time. On a day with a busy or important fire, what would happen is we'd get a ton of IPRs. So those are initial phone reports. So when the public calls in, so if you call *5555 or doing the app reporting, that those all through Victoria get pushed onto our screen. And it can become pretty busy on our screen. We're getting dozens of these flashing reports where we have to make sure they're all reported to the appropriate officer based off of the location that they're happening in. And sometimes we might not have those if it's in the Cassiar, say it's in Atlin. People might be seeing it, but there's no cell service to call them in. There can sometimes be really big fires, but we're not getting that public perspective and off the get-go. And then usually what it is often dispatching crews, appropriate aircraft, and if necessary, air tanker requests. So again, that requesting retardant or suppressant. So those are our skimmers. Often ATR, so air tanker requests, will be pushed when it's a challenging place to get to. So the crews need a bit of time for it to hold before they can action the fire, or if they're there but there's no water source available, and so they have to cut a hose lay or cut a trail to the nearest water source. So we're the ones who are in contact with the crews and the aircraft as they're leaving for the fires. And when it often gets the most busy is when there's multiple targets that they have to manage all at once. That could be multiple targets in the same area, or it could be completely spread out. And I think it's hard to maybe picture it, but I think imagining that you're getting all the information to one single person and it's all going on one screen, it can be really busy. And often you have the you have the officers in the zone itself and then the officers in the room telling you what to do. And so you're having to make sure you're following the direction. And specifically because we're a small center, often there will only be one or two dispatchers on at a time. So if you're having busy activity in two zones, that's all you have. And so it's a lot of helping each other out. And it can look like working a 16-hour day when your regular day is only 9 hours or something like that. Yeah, that's what it looks like to me. And it, what's interesting is it never happens when you think it's going to happen.
Right. Yeah.
Totally.
So it's funny because I've noticed that this dispatch crew seems to be like a younger group of people. Yeah. Is that typical, or are dispatchers typically younger, or why is this? Because I don't know if this is strange or if this is maybe where a lot of people cut their teeth and then go on to operations after that. Is that?
Yeah, so actually it's not a pretty normal trajectory to go from dispatch to operations. Dispatch is often not really seen as transferable in other parts of wildfires. If you were to want to go into operations, you would have to go onto a crew to establish that boots on the ground experience. We're a secondary center, so we transfer our radios over to a primary center in the wintertime when we don't have any fire activity. However, we do have, like, the contracts that we have are from February to November, but if you're a student, you're allowed to take them from May to August. And so they work really well with young people who are wanting to do school. So I think it's conducive to people who are able to be a little bit more, probably have fewer responsibilities outside of work. I would say our room is probably one of the youngest rooms. And I think it also might be an awareness piece of maybe other people aren't aware that this is a job, that it's an opportunity. I think if we were to increase the contracts to year round, maybe it would attract a different demographic of people. But knowing from other fire centers that I'd say probably the average age is probably mid-20s.
What makes a good dispatcher, and what are maybe some of those subtler qualities that are hard to maybe even ask for on a resume that surprises you when you're working with a team?
I'd say that what I notice, because we have a really strong dispatch room, and so when I think about what makes a strong dispatcher, I think about the dispatchers we have in our room. Obviously, you know, you need to be detail-oriented, which can sometimes be a bit, seem a bit naggy. Sometimes we'll be on the cruise and be like, was that decimal 49 or decimal 48 kind of thing? But the thing is, we have a pretty small margin of error in our job. So having to be really oriented towards precision, even when things are crazy, is super important for getting the appropriate coordinates for an incident, especially when we're having to respond to like medical evacuations and things like that. Making sure that the person who's in the seat is paying attention to every little thing is super crucial. And so that's something that you can ask for on a resume, but it can be pretty hard to pick that out until someone's actually done our specific job. Right. Some of our dispatchers have been lifeguards before, or they've done first aid or first response, stuff like that. And that can often be a really strong indicator that someone will be able to be very suited. So I will say it can be hard to pick that out in a resume. But what I've noticed that has helped me, and which I think will inform future hiring, with this being the first year that I've done hiring, is people who are really creative is really good. And so creative in terms of their thinking, because specifically in the Northwest, we have to do things in unorthodox ways, mainly because we have massive communication challenges that other fire centers might not have. For example, we have entire parts of our fire center that have no cell service and almost no repeater coverage.
A repeater is a tower that receives the radio signal on one frequency and simultaneously transmits the same signal onto another frequency. Typically, a repeater is placed in a location where it can have a virtual line of sight to all radios in the system. What Maya has explained here is that in the Northwest Fire Center and the area of BC that's covered, that's not always an option for dispatch.
So dispatchers have to be very creative and, okay, this person is Mr. Check-in. I have to go track them down. What am I going to do? And so people who are willing to think outside of the box and think, oh, there's that one guy who called in that fire on the radio and telegraph, and he mentioned that he might know them, so I'm going to radio him, and those kinds of things. And being, I think, what comes to mind is being really dynamic and up for anything. Sometimes we can get really wanting to follow a certain procedure. So you have to be very procedure oriented, because especially if you have a medical evac, you have to follow all the steps. For starting a fire, we have to follow the steps. But at the same time, knowing how unpredictable a fire is, you also have to be very dynamic and very open to, you have to be okay with, be okay with maybe not the most conventional of circumstances in this job. I find that people who are pretty up for anything really succeed in this environment. I think lots of introverts are attracted to dispatch, but being really, really team-oriented is really important, specifically in our center, because everyone's helping each other out. It's never just you're left alone, it's your sinking ship kind of thing. Everyone is willing to pick up the slack for someone if they're busy and they aren't able to follow all their kind of other procedures that they otherwise should be. And I've just noticed that in our room.
When you are looking for new people to work in the operations department, what are the qualities that are hard to ask for, but that you know makes a good operations worker?
I guess if we're speaking more towards like the operations officer role, we're looking for someone who has some good senior fire lines experience as well as certifications. A big part of it too is when you do step into that role, you are a leader for overseeing the room. And as we get busier and busier, we actually start to build out sections as well. So it's everything from liaising with the zones, helping them go after initial attack targets, to overseeing the regional air branch coordinator, ensuring that we have enough aircraft and the right kind of aircraft, as well as managing that dispatch room in itself too. Because when it gets busy, we start to break each pod off to represent and respond to each one of our zones that we have out there. So it can get pretty chaotic in there. So someone who's able to keep a cool head under pressure.
In
prevention, I was still thinking operations.
In operations, what I would say also is real important is flexibility and being able to adapt to the situation. For me, it's like a bit of a chess game with Mother Nature, and you have to be flexible enough to adapt to what's coming in the next minute, the next hour, and the next day, and be able to just work with that. You can't stick to a plan or a process or you won't be successful. Now that question, and then I'll put my prevention hat on. In prevention, curious, skeptical, and humble. Those are the three qualities I look for.
How have wildfire behaviors changed in the last two decades?
How has wildfire behavior changed in the decades? I would say from my experiences, because there's not a lot of studies and science and some reports out there, but for me, for the province of British Columbia, one of the biggest changes that I have seen is the change that the mountain pine beetle has caused in the forests of British Columbia.
The mountain pine beetle outbreaks in BC and the US were fueled by a changing climate. In the past, mountain pine beetle usually produced one generation of young beetles per year, and those populations were controlled by cold winter temperatures that killed most of the beetles. But with longer, warmer summers, the beetles began to have two generations per year. And with warmer winter temperatures, more of the beetles survived to breed again the next year. What's more, the mountain pine beetle was able to survive at higher elevations, where extreme cold had previously kept them at bay. Until the early 2000s, the mountain pine beetle outbreak, then the largest forest insect epidemic in the history of Canada, was largely confined to BC. The mountain pine beetle could not survive the cold winter temperatures high in the Rocky Mountains. But by 2005, the beetles had managed to cross the Rockies into Alberta, where they attacked not only lodgepole pine, but also jack pine, a species that is native across boreal Canada, all the way to the Atlantic. In all, the mountain pine beetle affected about 180 square kilometers, an area about the size of New Brunswick plus two Nova Scotias.
There's various numbers out there. I've heard anywhere from 16 to 18 million hectares have been affected by the pine beetle to varying degrees. That has had an impact from the initial when they were red and dead standing right through to what Chris just described, to hot, intense fires. I think when you look at a lot of the large fires that we've had on the landscape that people are calling things like mega fires and unusually large, a lot of those are the result of the mountain pine beetle. I think that has had the biggest effect, and there's various reasons for the pine beetle that we can attribute to the cause of that. And I'm not sure what the degrees, but some slightly warmer summers, fire suppression, and overall land management practices have all contributed to that state that we're currently in.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.